You are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. Almost everyone is in favor of advancements in green energy, but we're still a long way off from cleaner sources being able to take over from more traditional forms of energy, like fossil fuels. If we were to make the switch now, it would inevitably mean moving from a high energy society to a low energy society. But what would this mean in practice? Today I'm speaking with the IEA's head of education, Dr. Steve Davies. Steve paints a picture of radical changes that would have to be made in order to adapt to a low-energy society. Two major changes include a return to agriculture focus in local areas, with over 30% of the population needing to return to the farms to make sure communities could be fed. Furthermore, it would almost certainly mean a return of traditional gender roles, as it was the many advancements in energy in particular that enabled women to liberate themselves out of the home and into the workforce. And while many people who advocate for a low energy society seem to think that the things they like will continue, while the things they loathe will be scrapped, Steve argues that many conveniences and indeed miracles of modern society, like international plane travel and use of the internet, would be wiped out almost completely, with only the world's elite having access to such luxuries. Those who want a greener planet should be the biggest advocates of technological advancement, Steve argues, as too early a shift into green energy completely could actually pull us back into the past. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. Steve, thanks for joining me today. One of the major discussions in political forums is about the future of energy, and everyone's looking to green energy. People think that this is going to be the solution to our environmental problems. A lot of that discussion revolves around renewable energy. Is it going to be the savior that many people claim it is?
Well, not in the way that many people think it will be, because the common assumption seems to be that we are going to continue having a high energy use society, with the only difference being really that we get that energy from wind power, wave power, solar power, rather than from fossil fuels and nuclear energy. And that is simply not the case. You cannot replace the kind of level of energy consumption that we have today with renewable sources of energy without a couple of major technological breakthroughs.
What kind of breakthroughs might be needed?
Well, it's worth saying, you know, what the problems are really, because that's what makes clear what the breakthrough we need is. First of all, you need the fossil fuels to actually build the infrastructure that you need for a switch to renewable energy. And also, more importantly, to maintain it. The thing is, in a very real sense, these are not renewable. Because the last time I looked, things like windmills didn't spring up out of the ground from seeds the way trees do. They have to be built. They have to be maintained because they break down quite regularly. And all that requires energy. Now, if the energy used to make the windmills and the tidal power stations comes from those power stations and windmills, you're going to have very little left over, actually, to maintain the network or to build it. So that's one problem. There's also the well-known problem of intermittency and location. The sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day, but we use electricity 24 hours a day. The wind doesn't blow all the time, as we know right now here in London. Also, most of the really large reserves of renewable energy are in parts of the world, like north of the Arctic Circle, or in the roaring 40s in the Southern Hemisphere, where nobody lives, for very good reason. So the problem is you can generate a ton of, say, solar electricity in the Sahara, but nobody lives there. How are you going to get it to where it's needed? One big problem is that renewable energy is not an exact replacement for fossil fuels in particular. In particular, it's very, very difficult to see how renewable energy can be used to power things like transportation, not just cars, but in particular things like ships and aircraft. And then finally, and this is the really big problem, most renewable energy has very low energy density. What I mean by that is that a relatively small amount of space is taken up by, let's say, a barrel of oil, and out of that barrel of oil you get a lot of energy. To get the same amount of energy out of, say, solar power, you would have to cover several hectares of land with solar panels. So in order to get enough electricity to run a medium-sized town in the United States out of solar power, you would have to cover an area of land the size of Los Angeles County to get the amount of energy you require.
Wow.
Because although there's a lot of solar energy falling on the planet's surface, it's very diffuse. It's spread out over an enormous geographical area. And that means that if you do move to that kind of energy, because of all these four problems, you simply aren't going to be able to generate enough energy without enormous cost to sustain the civilization we have. So the technological breakthrough we need is essentially a means of storing, transporting, and above all, compressing energy. You could say that what we need is a super battery, really, except that we need something which is as far beyond a battery as a jet aircraft is beyond, the Wright brothers' aeroplane, basically, a whole order of magnitude higher level of technology. Without that kind of technological breakthrough, which we're nowhere near at the moment, we will not be able to have a high-energy society based upon renewable energy.
We don't have that high-charged battery yet, but of course many environmentalists, and not just people who associate that way, people who care about the environment, are saying that we need to make changes now. We can't wait a decade or five decades for this to come in. So if we were to make substantial changes now in the way that we're using fossil fuels and the way that we're consuming and using energy, it would mean transferring to a low-energy society and economy, and it would mean doing that quite quickly. What would the ramifications of that be?
Well, very extensive. Now, it's worth saying that many environmentalists and green thinkers and advocates of one kind or another quite openly say that they do want to move to a low-energy society, not only because they think it's necessary because of things like global warming, but also because they want to do it anyway, because it will reduce the environmental impact of human beings upon the planetary biosphere. So they think that actually this is a good thing. However, the problem I have with a lot of the writing about this is that the picture of what a low-energy society would be like is, to put it mildly, deeply misleading. Essentially, what you find is people saying, well, all the things I like about the world I'm in now will continue, and the things that I don't like about the world we're in now, well, they'll stop. So you get lots of people, for example, saying, oh, we'll still have the internet, and as I'll explain in a moment, that is simply not on, to put it quite frankly. So, yes, there are a whole range of implications to having a low-energy society compared to the one that we're in now. One of them is that there will be, quite simply, a lot less transport. There will be, for example, no aeroplanes. In a low-energy society, absent the kind of breakthrough in technology I mentioned, you simply will not have heavier-than-air transport, because the only thing that makes that possible is the fact that fossil fuels have high energy density and are very light. If you had a battery-powered plane, you'd have maybe one passenger. It just wouldn't be economic. So you can forget about air passenger transport, long-distance air freight, and all that that implies. Forget about your foreign holidays. Just not going to happen. Foreign holidays are going to go back to being, at the very most, a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But even more importantly, it means that you will not be able to ship goods in huge quantities the way we now do at sea in large ships, because, again, almost half the ship would be taken up with batteries, basically, if you're not using fossil fuels to power it. And so what that means is that you would have far less economic integration. You would have a much more localized economy. You would have a much poorer economy because our productivity would decline dramatically. But in addition to that, you'd also have a much less cosmopolitan world. People would be much more locally focused. You would not have the level of internationalism or international cooperation that we now have. People wouldn't be making foreign trips all the time. They'd maybe make more in their lifetime. We'd move back to the kind of world that really our ancestors inhabited in the early 19th century, say, where there was very little connection compared to what there is today between different parts of the world. So we'd move towards localism, probably nationalism, and away from cosmopolitanism and economic integration. So that's one huge change.
I think your point about air travel and foreign trips being once-in-a-lifetime experience can really resonate with listeners. But can we break down the goods and services a bit as well? Because, you know, at the moment, a lot of people say we should be buying locally, we should be buying British beef, British milk. Actually, that argument could resonate with some people, but we're not just talking about meat and milk. I mean, most of the everyday goods and services that we've come to expect are very often not made in the UK.
No, the great majority.
And you wouldn't have any access. It's not that you would get your computer in the UK and your meat and your milk and your clothes. You actually wouldn't have access to some products.
Yeah, exactly. The point is that the cost of many products would become so high that they would be beyond the means of virtually any person on an average or even above average income. Computers and mobile phones would be an example of that, actually. They are built requiring components and raw materials like rare earths, which are only found in distant parts of the world, mainly in China in the case of rare rare earth metals. If you didn't have cheap, long-distance maritime transport, there's no way you could make laptop computers or mobile phones in the UK at anything other than a cost, which would make them a pure luxury good available only to the top 1 or 2% of the population. And it's true even for more mundane products. Take clothes, for example. All those cheap T-shirts, cheap clothes that you buy in Primark and elsewhere, they're made in Bangladesh or other parts of South Asia or even Africa increasingly. There's no way they could be made for anything like that kind of low cost if they were manufactured here in the United Kingdom. And you would basically go back to the situation you had, say, in the 1950s, where most people had about a tenth of the amount of clothes that they now have. You might welcome that, but you've got to accept that's what you have to. That's what you'd have to face up to.
And a lot of people wouldn't welcome that.
No, indeed, a lot of people would not welcome it. Yes.
What else would change in a low energy society?
The other really big change is that agriculture would have to be done completely differently. Because what a lot of people don't realise is that the major input into most farming today is not labour or even capital; it's energy. Specifically petroleum in the form of pesticides, herbicides and other inputs, fertilizers in particular, which come from fossil fuels. Now, if you stop using fossil fuels, and if you also stop using fossil fuels to power things like tractors and agricultural machinery or don't use it as much, then what you're going to have to do is to basically put about 30% of your population back into farming. So you'd have to go from the situation we have now, where about 1 to 1.5% of the population in a developed country is engaged in agriculture, to a situation where about 30 to 40% of your population is engaged in agriculture. Now that's obviously an enormous change. I mean, it's such a huge social change that the ramifications would take you months, even years, to actually spell out. It's so massive. But that would be inevitable, because the only alternative would be starvation, which obviously you don't want. So, sure, you can feed the world's population through a low-energy form of agriculture, permaculture as it's called, but that would require massive, massive labour inputs. And the only way you can do that is by having a very large part of your population engaged in agriculture.
Steve, that sounds horrifying in the sense that, you know, what we're trying to do now is when we look around the globe and we see where absolute poverty still exists, it is often people who are forced to work on farms, who don't have an education, they have very little, and they can't do anything else. It's about building up those societies so people can get an education, move into more high-skilled work. And in this low-energy society, I mean, we're talking about moving at least a third of the population back to those conditions.
Well, to be fair to them, the people who are aware of this, and there are various authors on the green side, you might say, who have actually made this very point that I've just made, they argue that they won't be living in those kind of poverty-stricken conditions. They argue that they will be living in the countryside, but with access to a lot of modern amenities like modern medicine, sanitation, and the like. Now, that may be true, but there are a couple of other things which they will not have. And that's where I think your point does have force. One of them is that, well, to go back to a point I made earlier, you forget about the internet. When people talk about the cloud, this implies that you're talking about something ethereal, immaterial. Actually, the cloud is just thousands of large computers stacked up in gigantic warehouses. The internet now uses more energy and causes more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire international airline industry. If you move to a low-energy economy, there's no way the internet is going to survive. Social media and all that goes along with that, that's not going to survive either. But most importantly, I think, what you are going to see is a reversion to traditional household structures and gender roles. Because what we've seen in the course of the last 100 years is a process by which the work that used to be done on an unpaid basis, mainly by women in the household, is increasingly done on a paid basis outside the household. And that is made possible by relatively cheap and abundant energy. If we go back to a world in which energy is relatively scarce, less used, then all kinds of tasks and jobs are going to have to move back into the household sphere. Now, I am prepared to take pretty long odds against that being anything other than a reversion to traditional gender roles. So not only are you going to have about 30% of your population back in agriculture, even though they may be enjoying a better standard of living than peasant farmers in the third world do today, what you will find, I'm absolutely certain is that there will be a strong reversion back to a very traditional kind of family structure in which women do all the kind of domestic roles that they've increasingly been able to escape from, being defined by or bound by, due to high energy usage.
Because it is that high energy usage, as you say, that has brought a lot of the chores that happened in the house outside of the house. Of course, with things like transport and modern technology and access to education, all of which require high energy, women have been able to progress in the work sphere. And
yes,
they've been able to get out of the home. And yeah, we're talking about taking a lot of that away.
Yes, absolutely. You're talking about going, not going back to the way things were 200 years ago. That would be unfair. But what you're talking about doing is having a society which in some ways is still high tech, but which, because it is low energy, is in many ways going to be very like the society that we had before industrialization, in terms of things like lack of integration across national borders and on a global scale, social roles, the proportion of the population engaged in agriculture, and also a whole range of other things, such as the kind of level of communication that we now take for granted through things like social media, the internet, email, and even things like the telephone and television and radio. These will become much more difficult to have on the kind of scale that we're accustomed to. So it isn't going back, but it's going, if you like, forward to something that's remarkably like a traditional pre-modern society.
I'm almost getting visions of the Hunger Games, because energy will feed in to the class system in an extremely real way. In District
yeah.
1, you know, everybody, the limited people who have access to all of the energy will still be living this extremely high-tech, fast life where they're able to do what they want and they have all the amenities at their fingertips. But people in District 12 or 13
yes.
are going to have nothing. They're going to be the ones working on the farms. You know, maybe they do have access to a good doctor or a good hospital, but otherwise, the women are back in the kitchen, the men are back out on the farms, and if you don't have access to energy, you're in poverty. I mean, it really feels like a way of actually entrenching the class system and making it harder for people to work their way up.
Yes, indeed, or creating a kind of neo-feudalism. Now, I know that the people I'm talking about here, the advocates of a radical reduction in energy usage, will say, well, you know, that's not going to happen, we're going to have a much more egalitarian society. Well, unfortunately, my answer is, well, good luck to that. As Damon Runyon once said, the race is not always to the swift, nor yet victory to the strong, but that's the way to bet. And that is what I would bet in this case, that unfortunately, you will indeed have a privileged elite. It'll be something which in many ways is a kind of feudal society. And it's worth saying, actually, that one of the ways in which feudal societies and past historic social orders worked was precisely that the elite had more access to energy than ordinary people. Now, the energy was animal energy, basically, mm-hmm. horses and slaves, typically. But that was the key basis of their higher standard of living. They got more access to energy than the common people, and that's why they were living a much better kind of life. Now, that is quite possibly what we will have reproduced if we go back to a low energy society.
This is fascinating, because I think very few people, including myself, have thought about energy in this way before. We always think of it as the fuel that's needed to get the jet off the ground. We think of it as all of the CO2 emissions coming out of manufacturing and big business. But we don't think of energy as being what gets us to work in the morning. We don't think of it as being what actually provides the sandwich in front of us that we didn't
yeah.
make. We don't think of it as what allows us to have daycare and childminders look after our kids as we go to work. Nobody thinks of energy in that way, but that is what it's being used for.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the ways of thinking about energy is that the real difference in many ways between our world, the modern world, and the world that all of our ancestors lived in up until about the middle of the 19th century, actually, is that we capture energy at much higher ratios. Our society is vastly more complex and therefore much wealthier and more productive than any previous society. And to a great degree, that is because we use energy at a rate that is much higher than that of any previous human civilization. And it's a straightforward calculation that if we go back to using energy at the kind of levels that were the norm in pre-industrial societies, then you're going to find that a lot of the ways of living that we now take for granted are just going to be done away with. They will no longer be sustainable.
So is there any optimism to be had here about the potential to get that supercharged battery? I mean, that's the ideal, right? To be able to live in a renewable energy kind of world that actually doesn't force us to go back to
I think that eventually we will do it. The point is that the need eventually will produce a response, is my sort of perhaps optimistic, but still my quite confident view. What I think will happen is this, that as fossil fuels become more difficult to get, as the large conventional fields decline, and the fields that we discover are more and more in difficult conditions or have high sulfur content, things like that, gradually the pressure manifested through the price system will be to find ways of making other forms of energy cheaper, but also more efficient, which means finding a way of storing and compressing them. Now, we can already see this. I mean, the cost of solar power, for example, has been coming down dramatically in the last few years in response to these sort of competitive pressures. But I think we're not quite at the point yet where fossil fuel supplies are in such straitened conditions that there's a strong enough incentive to really provoke a breakthrough in energy storage technology. And it could well be that we have a kind of rather rocky 10-year transition period where we know that we need this, but we don't have it yet. But I think in the end, somebody will do it. Now, I've called it a better battery, but actually it almost certainly will be nothing like a battery. Mm-hmm. It'll be a completely different kind of technology, maybe using superconductivity at normal temperatures or something like that. The point is, it will be essentially a way of not only storing energy, but above all, making it less diffuse, because it's the diffuseness of renewable energy that is its real Achilles heel.
So you say that there are some environmentalists at the moment who are speaking honestly about what a low energy society would look like. But I have to say, I have not heard these talking points from the Green Party. How do we get this argument to trickle out about what people would actually have to sacrifice in order to move to this kind of world?
I think it's just a point that you need to make over and over again. As I say, at the moment, there's a lot of wish fulfillment going on in which people who think, yes, we will have to move to a much lower energy society, imagine that the energy that we have will be used to provide the things that they like, and we will make up the gap by getting rid of the things that they don't like. And people just haven't thought through what it is. As I say, there are some authors who are quite straightforwardly confronting the kind of points I've made. People like James Howard Kunstler, for example, Richard Heinberg, some of the people over at the Post Carbon Institute, they've done very systematic thinking about that. The late Teddy Goldsmith did as well. I mean, he was in favour of a kind of neo-feudalism quite explicitly, actually, the man who founded The Ecologist magazine. Mm. But what is striking about the future I've described is that actually it's the kind of future that would appeal to people on what you might call the ultra-reactionary right. And yet, paradoxically, it's people who claim to be on the radical left who are in favour of moving to a low-energy world, which is bizarre, really, because actually they should be passionately in favour of having a world which is indeed high energy, but getting the energy from a different source. And the only way they can get that is with major technological breakthroughs. So they should be the people who are really rooting for lots and lots of new technology.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.